Good evening and welcome to the April 2026 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. We begin tonight connecting with my friend Nathan Mansky. He's the creator of an incredible collection of LGBTQ plus personal stories, now housed on his website, imfromdriftwood.com. Nathan was one of my first guests on this show just after he launched this website. And then Finn Dearheart shares his conversation with award-winning author Jody Rosenberg. Finn will tell you himself that Jody's book, Night Night Fawn, is a book he just couldn't put down. So stay with us. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, April 26th, 2026. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of April 26th, 2026. The Gilbert Baker Foundation is celebrating a major victory for LGBTQ plus visibility. After a long battle, the National Park Service has resolved a lawsuit over the removal of the Rainbow Pride flag from the Stonewall National Monument. This resolution guarantees that the flag will continue to fly at the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ plus civil rights movement, securing its place under current law and policy. The Gilbert Baker Foundation credited Lambda Legal, Washington Litigation Group, and co-plaintiffs, Equality New York and Village Preservation, for their work in the case. But as they point out, the fight is not over. The foundation is now pushing to ensure that all community flags, like the transgender flag and the progress flag, can fly freely at Stonewall and nationwide. They've already overturned or blocked a dozen flag bans in the United States and are supporting activists around the world from Ukraine to Kenya and Japan. With over 60 pride flag bans still in effect here in the U.S., the foundation says the battle for visibility continues. And Phil's Coffee reversed its controversial decision to remove pride flags from its cafes. The CEO issued an apology and acknowledged that the policy caused confusion and hurt, saying, quote, "I made a mistake and I am sincerely sorry." He emphasized that the pride flag is a symbol of safety and belonging, and all flags will now remain in place. The reversal comes a week after backlash, including a change.org petition from baristas, public criticism from State Senator Scott Wiener, and a protest in the Castro. The CEO met with San Francisco Pride Director Suzanne Ford and community advocate Jennifer Peraza before deciding to restore the flags. Suzanne Ford said the move sent a powerful message at a time when LGBTQI people are navigating an increasingly hostile climate. And in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, the Stonewall National Museum, Archives, and Library will launch Pride Month with two major events starting on Saturday, May 30th. First, the opening of the Many Faces of Pride, a multi-layered exhibition reflecting LGBTQ plus identity, history, and resilience. And then second, the inaugural Stonewall Honors Dinner, celebrating 10 leaders and organizations making lasting contributions to the movement. A new permanent interactive exhibit will also debut that evening, enshrining the honorees' stories both at the museum and online for audiences nationwide. President and CEO Robert Keston said that the initiatives ensure that the work and courage of those trailblazers will live on, reminding everyone that equality is a fight carried by the entire community. And meanwhile, in the state of Texas, the Texas Tech University system is shutting down all academic programs centered on sexual orientation and gender identity. Chancellor Bryden Creighton issued a directive to identify and phase out all majors, minors, and certificates where these topics serve as a main focus. The new policy also prohibits faculty from teaching that gender identity is fluid or that more than two genders exist. Women and gender studies programs will be the most affected. Current students in the programs may finish their degrees, but no new admissions will be allowed. Future hiring of staff will also follow the new restrictions. Critics, including faculty and civil rights attorneys, say the move is politically motivated, limits academic freedom, and undermines students' education. And in Washington, after telling federal appeals judges no involuntary separations had happened, the Trump administration now says they have begun. The Pentagon began moving to remove transgender service members from the military. The Department of Justice acknowledged in a new court filing identifying two plaintiffs now facing separation proceedings under President Trump's ban. In a letter filed last week with the U.S. Court of Appeals for Washington, D.C., government attorneys said the Air Force has initiated involuntary separation processes against Cadet Hunter Marquez and First Lieutenant Sean Hirsch Hammer, both plaintiffs in the case. According to the filing, both have been served formal notices and have requested hearings before administrative separation boards. The disclosure follows earlier statements by the Department of Justice attorneys during oral arguments suggesting that no transgender service members had been discharged under the policy. In January, plaintiffs challenged that characterization, accusing the government of misleading the court. U.S. District Judge Anna Reyes suggested to Justice Department lawyers in March that they inform the circuit court about the government's actions against transgender troops and clarify any confusion. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. You know, one of the things that's always amazed me about our LGBTQ plus community is how individuals identify a need and they take action to create a solution and then build something incredible. Nathan Mansky is one of these amazing people who I admire so much. Nathan was inspired as a young gay man by Harvey Milk and by Harvey's belief in the power of sharing personal stories. Over the last 17 years, Nathan has collected the personal stories of over 800 members of the LGBTQ plus community from across the United States. They're all housed on the website imfromdriftwood.com, something I would call a full library of experience. Nathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, I was reflecting, as we talked about before we started, you know, the first time I had you on the show, and realized it was just about the time that I started doing the Outbeat Radio show, which was 17 years ago. Can you believe
that?
But who's counting? But for our listeners who don't know about I'm From Driftwood and where the whole idea came from, take us back to that original concept and where you got the idea to do this.
Yeah, so it was about 18 years ago that the film Milk had come out. And if you're not familiar with it, Milk was a film that came out in 2008 about Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay elected official in California. He was elected supervisor and was at City Hall. An incredible film. It was starring Sean Penn, who I believe won the Oscar that year for it. It was written by Dustin Lance Black, who certainly won the Oscar for writing that that year. Just an incredible film. That really highlights just the importance of Harvey Milk in our history, not just the queer and trans history and the movement, but American history as well. So saw that movie, was really, really moved by it. And the morning after watching the film, I was thinking about this famous photograph of Harvey Milk. And he is sitting in the San Francisco Pride March. He's sitting on the hood of a car. And he's holding this big sign that simply reads, "I'm from Woodmere, New York." And I was thinking about that photograph and like why I kept thinking about it and what it meant to me. And it finally hit me that everyone associates Harvey Milk with San Francisco, this big queer and trans mecca, you know, but here he is saying, proclaiming that he is not from there. He's from this town that most people have never heard of. And I was in New York City at the time in Brooklyn, and that really stood out to me because, yes, I was living in New York City at the time, but I'm not from there. I'm from Driftwood, Texas, which is a very small town, grew up on a ranch. And to me, that meant that you're not alone. No matter where you are, queer people are everywhere. And no matter what you're going through or where you are, that you're not alone. And so it was all from that photograph of Harvey Milk. And I wanted to get that message of you're not alone out there through storytelling. And it all just clicked, you know, like all at once. That photo made me feel like that's the message I needed to hear when I was a gay teenager in Driftwood, Texas. And I really believed that that message would likely be important to other people as well. And so it was a hunch. It was very personal to me. And I told all, I didn't have anything else figured out. All I knew is that I wanted to get that message out there through storytelling. And I started telling all my friends about it. Everyone rallied around me, helped me build it, design it. I didn't have experience with any of that stuff. And 3 months later, imfromdriftwood.com was launched. So
incredible. And I think one of the things that you were inspired by was Harvey Milk. And Harvey always believed in the power of storytelling. I never heard this directly from him, but I've seen videos of him talking about the way that we change hearts and minds is through storytelling. So talk about the videos that are on imfromdriftwood.com and how you think they are changing hearts and minds.
Yeah, it's funny. There's something else that Harvey apparently said. He talked about how he, whenever he was in City Hall, he would always be sure to take the stairway, this big set of stairs in City Hall, because it makes him more visible. So, because so many people, like, I don't know anyone who's queer or trans, and his whole belief was like, yes, you do. And so he would never take the elevator because it, it hides him. And he decided to always take the stairs, which were in the middle. And if you Google the San Francisco City Hall, you'll understand, like, this big
Close
stairway in the middle, and he would always make sure to take the stairs, just to be that he could make more of an entrance and more of a presence, and to be visible. So visibility, it was really important to him as well. So it's funny you brought up the point about changing hearts and minds. We recently, we've always believed this, but we didn't have the research behind it. But there's some recent research that shows the only thing that changes hearts and minds of the movable middle. This research was done after the 2024 election, so a lot of people were, like, why were these attack ads on trans people so effective? So they kind of reverse engineering that and trying to figure out, why are people so transphobic? And the research showed that the only thing that moved moderate and conservatives and the trans and their views of trans people was narrative storytelling. If they were shown stories of trans people on social media, told stories about them, it was the only thing that worked. There's no facts, no figures, no data, no reports, none of that stuff, no arguing. It was only storytelling. And of course, this was, we just found this research last year. It was just conducted last year. But we've believed that,
Sure.
and we've been pushing that. So it's, and based on our all the comments we see on these stories, we certainly have evidence to support that belief. So it is, it re storytelling really is powerful in that way. And I several years ago, we had this amazing intern, as we also have one now. And I was curious. I was like, we kind of know it in our hearts that storytelling is important, but we wanted to really get to the be able to explain that and justify it in some way, in a real way. So I asked our intern, her name was Holly, to just do some research. I was like, I don't really know exactly where to guide you, but can you try to find something that we can back this up with? And what she came back with was amazing. It was that a neurological explanation of to what empathy is. And whenever you tell somebody a story, and you tell it well, and this is, I'll touch on this later, but as long as there's vivid scenes and descriptions and dialogue, as long as the listener can imagine themselves in that story, they're act you're act they're the storyteller is activating something called mirror neurons. And whenever those are firing, that's the basis and scientific explanation of empathy. So, like, literally it's changing people's minds on this neurological level, telling a story. It's like whenever you get that feeling like, oh, I get you, or why we cry at movies, like, this isn't happening to me, but it is on this neurological level. Your brain is experiencing what they experience. And that's what empathy is. That's why it's able to change hearts and minds. So it was really interesting to dig into all this, like, nerdy science stuff, all through this otherwise, like, artistic, creative world of storytelling.
Wow, little did you know 18 years ago. But
Nope. Yeah.
you've built this, and it's literally a library-sized collection of stories from all over the country, from all kinds of different people. Give us a sense of some of the demographics or the statistics you have around the size of the collection you have.
Yeah, so we it's really evolved over the years. We started with only written stories. That way, anyone could submit a story, they just write it up and send it in. And then he was a board member, one of my best friends, Marquise. He had the idea of doing these video stories where we sit with people and they would tell me their story, and he would film it and edit it and publish it. And it was a huge success. And in fact, that's all we do now are video stories. We don't even do written stories. But Overall, with the video stories, we have about close to 800 video stories now, and then another 500 or so written stories. And you mentioned a library, and that's really what we, being 17 years old now, we're kind of this wasn't the intent when we started, but we're kind of becoming this historical archive of queer and trans history. But we're as this unfolding and as this happening. So one thing that I'm very glad we did early on is that we have transcribed all of our stories. We've added tags and metadata so that if you want to find stories from Texas, you just click Texas and all the stories from Texas will pull up. If you want stories from people who are bisexual, you just click the bisexual tag. We have different races. We have an elders tag, different categories. Stories that touch on immigration. So we've done a really good job of categorizing and cataloging our stories. And the inspiration was a library. We're like, if you walk in, sometimes you know exactly what you want and you should be able to find it, And then, but other times you're like, I don't know, I like science fiction. I'll just go to this section and browse. And you can do that at I'm From Driftwood. So yeah, so we have stories of all kinds. Video stories, written stories. We had a couple seasons of a podcast that we did because some people we were at a fundraiser one time in Philadelphia, and somebody came up after and she said, I love what you guys do. I love storytelling, but I'm a podcast girl. I haven't seen any of your videos because I just don't watch videos. It's not how I consume media. So we. We're trying to tap into all the different ways to tell a story. So we had I think we have over 50 episodes of a podcast that's available. So yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. As you know, I use these in my classes, and when the students are exploring intersectionality, it's so great because we can look at different aspects of different racial groups and different nationality groups, and then have some discussion around how those identities intersect with sexual orientation and gender identity. And there's nothing better than hearing that happen, or hear how that happens from the individuals. You have to have just heard so many different stories from so many different people. And this is probably an unfair question. Is there one that kind of stands out to you as being maybe the most moving for you personally?
Parents with children, I love all of our stories equally, Greg. You know that. I'm not going to answer. I'm not going to
That's
choose a
right.
favorite. Come on.
That was the
No,
right answer.
but it changes stories that stand out changes over time for me. And there's one story that it right in this moment that stands out because we filmed it about oh gosh, like 15 years ago. But something we're doing right now is going back and re-editing some of the older stories to be better suited for social media and shorter form platforms. So, because most of our stories are about 4 to 6 minutes long, but no one's going to watch that on Instagram. So, Damien is my colleague. He's a master at like getting these 6 minute stories and cutting them down to 90 seconds or 2 minutes. And so we did this to one of our stories that we collected about 15 years ago. His name is Novale Gonzalez, and it was an amazing story when we published it. It was about 5 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, and then the whole point of re-editing these older stories is to introduce them to new audiences. And this was just a home run success. It's our most viewed by far Instagram reel. It has over 1 million views on its
Wow.
own. And the reason is like, you always hope that the fun stuff, like the high views and subscribers and all that stuff, the quantitative stuff is aligned with like the impact or the value of the meat of the story. And this one is just perfect because the story is really powerful and beautiful. Novale talks about how he was being, and Novale presents very slightly feminine or maybe non-binary, longer hair, wears a lot of jewelry, and very soft-spoken. And talks about when he was a child, he was bullied at school and came home and was very upset. And his grandpa was like, "Hey, what's going on?" And he explained what was happening, and he said, "Listen, if you never if you only he remember one thing I ever tell you, I want it to be this: that because of who you are, there will be enough people in your lifetime that will love you for exactly who you are, that you never have to worry about the ones that don't." And
Wow.
it changed his life. And he's telling this story. He was probably in his 50s or 60s when he's telling it, a story from, 40 years earlier. And he took that advice with him forever. And it was powerful enough for him to be sharing it on this story. So and then of course the comments, it just were everyone was just so moved by that. Like, that's advice anyone can take,
Sure.
and it was just really one of those just beautiful moments, beautiful stories that so that one is certainly on my mind right now.
All right. Well, let's take a listen so you can get an example of what's available. Of course, this is just the audio side of it, but enjoy.
My name is Novalay Gonzalez, and I'm from here in Hawaii. I was born and raised here on the Windward side, which is at the time that I grew up, which was 66 years ago, was the country. So I grew up in the country of Hawaii. The LGBT person in the ancient times was actually revered and thought to be blessed and sent by the gods, because they were the ones that were the nurturers, they were the teachers, they were the hula instructors, they were the kumus. They were the ones that took care of the children, raised the children in the history of what Hawaii really is. So there was a place for them in our society, and they were revered for that. And then as the Western culture mingled with ours, then things changed. But the structure is so embedded in those that are Hawaiian and in the Hawaiian Islands itself, in the aina, as we say, everything that we as Hawaiians consider sacred, that it still exists today and it's still strong. I cannot remember myself not being gay. And I was extremely acceptable by my family, and in fact nurtured by them, because I was thought to be special. But I remember going to school one day and getting beaten up and called a sissy and a queer. And at the time I was staying with my grandfather, and I remember coming home and saying that I wanted to kill myself. And my grandfather says, "Why? Why are you so upset?" And I said, "Well, those kids at school, I don't want to go back to school. I want to kill everybody. I want to kill myself because they don't like me. They don't like who I am." My grandfather sat there. We sat there for a while. I says, "Well, Grandpa, aren't you going to say anything?" And he says, "Yes, I am. But what I know that what I that you're going to remember what I tell you. If you never remember anything I ever tell you, I want you to remember this: that because of who you are, there will be enough people in your lifetime to love you for exactly who you are, that you'll never have to worry about the ones that don't." And every time there's been a confrontation, every time there's been an incident where that would come up in my life, I would see him looking at me, and I would just realize, okay, you may not like me, but. And then I start thinking in my mind of all the people that do. And before you know it, yeah.
Wow, amazing. And it is really different to hear it directly from the person, even though we were just able to hear the voice. It's so much different than sort of secondhand storytelling, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because there's a certain power to first person storytelling. If I tell you a story that I heard from someone else, just as I did before, like explaining Novalay's story, it wasn't from me. It's not my story, but to hear it directly from Novalay, there's it adds a level of it adds some oomph to it.
Right. Well, I had a chance to contribute a story. It was a wonderful process. Are you looking for more stories? And if so, who do you want to hear from and how does that happen?
Yeah, actually, right now we, through some advice of some mentors and board members, we are sort of on a hiatus of producing new stories because we used to. It's hard to imagine that we did this, but we published a new story, a video story, every single week. It was a grueling, grueling schedule, and so what we did instead is we pivoted to going back to our library of stories and re-editing those. Because, as I mentioned, we have about 800 video stories.
Great.
So there's a lot of content that we can get from those that people have never seen. So we're focusing on those and re-editing those and bringing them to new audiences, just as we did with Novalaise, which clearly is making an impact on people. So that's what we're focusing on right now. We are hoping to get enough funding to resume producing new content. Really, we're such a small team. It's me and Damien and our very gracious volunteer board. But we were really kind of put in this position of having to choose. We either re-edit and re-edit the archive, or we continue producing new content. Right now we're re-editing content.
Well, it occurs to me, I mean, it's brilliant. And it occurs to me that my students were not born yet when this all started, right? So this is all new, brand new stuff for them who are coming into realizing what's available on this site. And this idea, I think it's remarkable that this idea you had that came from your heart has become your not only your passion, but it's your career. You do this full time.
I do. Yes, it's my full-time job and Damien's full-time job. And it's we one of my best friends actually is like, I know what like, he submitted a story. He helped build the initial website, and he said this recently. He was like, I still don't quite know what you do for work. And that's like it's because we're such a small, we do everything. I'm like, well, yesterday I submitted a grant proposal. Today I was like doing outreach to, we're hoping to have a house party fundraiser in Chicago. Like tomorrow, I'm following up with like some board member. Like it's just everything. It's like, oh yeah, I'm reviewing social media posts. Like it's just doing everything and just keeping the ship flowing. And same thing with Damien. He's technically I'm the executive director. He's the program director, and he does all the filming and editing. That's a clear line of work, but we're just yeah. Sometimes we're just we just do everything. So,
The life of running a nonprofit.
yep,
Yep.
absolutely.
So you are a 501c3 nonprofit, and there are obviously expenses to keep and to produce and provide all of this incredible content. Talk about the current campaign and what you'd like our listeners to know so they can be involved in supporting it.
Yeah, thank you. We were, I used to work in advertising, so we love a gimmick, but we to celebrate our 17-year anniversary, we're trying to raise $17,000. And that campaign is going on now, and we're only about $1,500 shy of it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so the community really came together and is supporting it, so we're almost there. So if you would like to push us over the edge, there is the URLs that we just transitioned to a different a fundraising platform. So it's called GiveButter, BUTT, like dairy, give butter. So you can go to givebutter.com/driftwood17.
Yep, perfect. Great site. Great. I use that all the time. And it's really super because as a donor, you'll get a letter you can use for your tax write-off. And you can help I'm from driftwood.com continue the great work. Talk about the site and remind our listeners of the URL to go to explore the videos and stories.
Yeah, you just go to imfromdriftwood.com. The I M do, doesn't have an apostrophe, but yeah, imfromdriftwood.com. Or just Google it. It'll, we've been around so long, our SEO is really great. And actually, that kind of just reminded me of a. I'm going to pivot here a little bit. Our SEO is really great because we've been around so long, and we transcribe all of our stories. There's a lot of tagging and really like good stuff that browsers like or web searches. But the reality is we live in this world where sometimes it's not always a good idea to have your sexuality or gender identity to be so public. So sometimes people ask if we've had people want their stories taken down, and the answer is yes. And usually it's because for work-related reasons, they're looking for a new job, and if you Google their name, their I'm from Drips with Stories, the first thing that pops up, which of course I'm like, yay. And they will reach out to us and say, I'm so sorry to ask this. I really believe in what you're doing. But if, I'm not sure how my potential employer is in terms of acceptance, in terms of, being okay with people being queer or trans. And we have a whole system. Damien has like a checklist. And we always say yes. We legally don't have to because we have everyone sign a release and, everything's official, but we never hesitate. We always say yes, of course, we're totally understanding. And Damien scrubs it from the internet the best he can. That includes removing their names, their, make them completely anonymous. And it takes a little while for Google to catch up, but Damien is really good at it. Everyone says the internet is forever, and it kind of is, but they haven't gone up against Damien. So,
Just gonna say,
but
yeah.
yeah, all that said, though, it's a reminder, though. Things are getting better, it seems like, and then, three steps forward, one step back, and it still happens off and on, where people neither they can't they go back into the closet a little bit, as they're looking for a job.
Right. That's sad. Well, hopefully your stories will continue to inspire and shove us 3 steps or 4 steps forward so we can make up for some of the lost ground we've had. Nathan Mansky, congratulations to you on this, somewhat of an anniversary. And we'll look forward to hearing more and watching this collection grow and grow.
All right. Thanks, Greg. Good to see you again. Thanks for having us.
And we'll be back with more right after this.
Confusion is nothing new. Flash.
And that was the always amazing Cyndi Lauper with Time After Time. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, Jordi Rosenberg is a novelist, having written many works, including Confessions of the Fox, shortlisted for the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize, a Lambda Literary Award, a Publishing Triangle Award, the UK Historical Writers Association debut Crown Award, and longlisted for the Dublin Literary Award. And it was also named one of the best books of the year by The New Yorker, among others. Jordi's work caught Finn Dearheart's attention, and he had a chance to chat with Jordi earlier this month.
Welcome to Outbeat News, Jordi Rosenberg.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Let me read your bio for our listeners at Outbeat. Jordi Rosenberg is the author of the novel Confessions of the Fox, shortlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, a Lambda Literary Award, a Publishing Triangle Award, the UK Historical Writers' Association Debut Crown Award, longlisted for the Dublin Literary Award, and named one of the best books of the year by The New Yorker, among others. Jordi's work has been supported by fellowships and residencies from McDowell, Lannan Foundation, BAMF, and the Society for the Humanities at Cornell University. Jordi is a professor in the Department of English and Associated MFA faculty in the Program for Poets and Writers at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Today we're discussing Jordi's new novel, Night Night Fawn, and I encourage everyone to pick up this book here. Well, you can't see it, you're just listening, but the book is actually stylistically beautiful, and it's one of my favorite books that I've read. So welcome, Jordi. Happy to chat with you for a little bit.
Thanks so much for having me. Please don't mind the sounds of dogs around.
Our listeners at Outbeat are familiar that I have dogs that have their own little sounds that they insert here and there too, so no worries. I wonder if you might tell our listeners a little bit of an overview about the book, just a little plot synopsis. I don't want to just bore people by reading the flap.
Well, yeah, the book is the fictional memoir of a character named Barbara Rosenberg, who is on her deathbed and being cared for by what she believes is a giant transgender bird who is demanding that she write a Marxist apology for her life. So that's a one sentence summary. Basically, the book is this forced apology, which Barbara doesn't really apologize, but she dances around the demand that she do so.
That's great. How long did it take you to boil all that down to that one line?
Not that long, weirdly, with this one. This one was a pretty crystallized, like, kernel from the beginning. I just at some point was like, I have to write this forced memoir of someone who's being made to speak in kind of Marxist lexicon and apologize for her entire life. I mean, the deathbed memoir is a pretty, you know, common, not unheard of genre. I think that in that way, sorry about that. I didn't think it would ring on my computer. Like Roberto Bolaño's By Night in Chile was a pretty inspiring sort of example of this, especially because it also has like a very unlikable point of view narrator. It's certainly stylistically very different, but it shares some conceptual elements.
Well, you mentioned too that I guess let's talk a little bit about the spectrum between memoir and it being a novel, and what you might have to say about that. I guess as a backdrop, I'm a writer, and I've been I'm playing constantly with genre. Does it want to be autofiction? Does it want to be memoir? And just still kind of in that process, I'm curious about your journey there.
Yeah, it started as my own memoir about taking care of my estranged mother, who was very homophobic, and taking care of her at the end of her life. But ultimately, I think I thought I could handle writing an entire book as memoir. I had written some like memoir essays that were the basis of selling the book as memoir. But I ultimately, sometimes things work as an essay that don't work as a book. And for me, this was not going to work as a book. It wasn't something I could really fall in love with as a form. Also, when you, for me, those memoir essays had a very academic framing because I'm an academic and I was originally hired in my job to teach 18th century British literature and like literary theory. So I was really a little bit sick of that tone. That was my own tone. And so narrating this, flipping it so that the narrator is actually the mother character was a way of sort of preventing against that very academic language from overriding the story, because she doesn't have that language, right? I was more interested in that kind of an experiment, I guess, and that is ultimately, I think, why I settled on doing it this way.
I love that. I love that you also brought up, she doesn't have that language, but I think too, the writer Jordi can't help but like be known. I mean, the language actually, Barbara Rosenberg and her grammar and her syntax and her language, and she has such a sharp vocabulary. So it's like,
Or probably sometimes where it does bleed through. And I mean, yeah, I mean, probably in some like metafictive way, I'm aware of that or okay with that, or these are concessions I had to make. But a lot of the time I just want her to be like delivering her observations in a very everyday, sticky way, which she does, I think. I tried not to get out of her character too much.
What was that like for you to be in her character?
It was a
This is a
very,
person.
yeah, no, it was not a good writing experience for me. It actually ended up being kind of bleak. Probably had something to do with like just, you know, mourning or expunging this voice from inside me, because it was very easy for me to ventriloquize my mother's voice, even though we had been estranged for so long and we differed politically, like almost diametrically. Our parents are how we learn language, you know, and it's embedded in you. And so I think there was like a an exorcism. I think I would describe the book as an exorcism, probably, although I'm not Catholic. It did feel a lot like that. So it wasn't the most fun writing experience, but it was a kind of a compulsion, I guess.
The kind of catalyzing of your experience, that your ongoing experience having been the son of this person, or at least a version of this person.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of like queer and trans people are usually, or at least of my generation, not raised in queer and trans families. So we have a lot of intel on these characters. We know them. And it's kind of like, what are you going to do with this intel? Like, you know, when I used to fight with my mother as a kid, I remember she was very into the theater and she was very theatrical. And she used to say, what are you crying about? I'm giving you material. Like, I mean, she was very conscious of, I'm giving you material and you can do what you want with it. Like almost like just setting me up to spike the ball, like just setting me up for the punchline. It was kind of wild. But we do have a lot of material and we can use it to satirize, to lampoon, to expose, to, you know, we don't have to be nice. It's not, being nice has not gotten us anywhere. And right now we're losing ground constantly to these assaults. And being nice is not going to win. So we have to fight and we have to galvanize ourselves. And sometimes part of galvanizing ourselves is laughing, is channeling anger through satire, you know, that these are the kinds of emotions I think that we need rather than, you know, niceness.
I 100% agree. And I really hope that people are taking that to heart too. Your the anger, the rage, those are necessary feelings. They're necessary because they help show us a direction I think that we could be going or should be going versus something's wrong with me for feeling all this.
Or sometimes you get stuck on like disbelief, like, is this really happening? And you know, sometimes underneath that disbelief is anger, like righteous anger. So it is really happening, and
How do you, Jordy, how do you metabolize, process what's going on in the world right now? I mean, it seems, I feel like this question is so vague, but I just curious, there's so many people have this response, and I hear this frequently from people that they feel kind of frozen, like not knowing what to do. And they like, well, I've called my senators and I just feel like now what do? I have to go to work. I can't, and just feel stuck. And I'm curious what you say to that.
I mean, it's terrifying. I mean, my own perspective has changed so much because everything's happening so quickly, right? And I before Scrimeti, before that Supreme Court decision, I think a lot of us were thinking, okay, you know, this is that's not really going to happen. There's a bottom to this, to how much they can take away trans people's rights. But when Scrimeti ruled that that Tennessee's ban on gender affirming medical care was constitutional, that I do think that a lot of people who were paying attention thought, okay, that like this is opening a portal. So even amongst people I know, you know, I think there's been a real shift in the past. Like, when was that? It was June. It was not even a year ago. Yeah, been a shift, I think. I think that I probably, you know, bounce around wildly from moment to moment, just like everybody else, right? Like, and I know so many people who are responding in different ways. There are a lot of trans people I know who are like, what's my plan B? How am I gonna tree? But you know, that's a complicated one. As we know, it's like a very privileged
Very.
position to be able to do that. And I don't actually fault anyone who does do that. And lots of people have had to immigrate for lots of different reasons. And obviously, this isn't a moral question. But the only thing that makes me feel better is like getting together with other people. General, but also like it is very grounding if you can be part of organizing in some way. And it doesn't have to be around transness specifically. I mean, it can be around your workplace. Like, unionizing a workplace is doing as much for trans people as anything else because trans people are workers. You know what I mean? Like, we need all our rights. So I think, you know, organizing and in whatever, you know, I mean, people organizing against ICE, people organize, there's so many things to organize about and around at this point. But building up your networks, I hate, I know that's what most people will say, but it actually genuinely is the only thing. It A is the only thing we can do that will save us, and then B, it does make you feel better. It makes you feel calmer when you're like, okay, there's a lot of us, we're working on it, we are, you know, and you start to be specific about the specific things that you're going to be struggling around, instead of having to think about it as this like giant miasma of evil fascist at us. Like, if you can zero in on, okay, what am I working on this week?
Totally. I think that's a great answer. I think that's helpful for people. I think too, many people might say that, but at the same time, I think repetition is so necessary to say it again and again and again. And for
Oh,
people
yeah.
who, getting out of the frozen space can take a while, and so
Yeah.
If hearing it again is helpful, I'm happy to broadcast that message again.
You know, like, I saw that you actually had Lara Sheehy on your program, and somewhere I had read she said something really useful that was around this question of repetition. It was, and I'm not going to get it right because I don't have it right to hand, but it was something about the repetitive nature of Zionism and colonialism and how it will, and it keeps coming. And the only thing we can do is kind of like, subvert that repetition compulsion, I think is how she was describing it, back as resistance. In other words, even when it feels futile, even when it feels like it's not going to do anything, you have to keep repeating the resistance, the saying of what you're doing in resistance. Like I think she described like some kind of anti-colonial and anti-capitalist repetition compulsion that I think I found very, very helpful, because you don't always have to believe it. In fact, with repetition compulsion, she doesn't say this, but anyone who's experienced a repetition compulsion, you often don't, you know, it's in that this, you might not believe that it actually will do whatever it is you think it's going to do. Like, if I count to 10, you know, whatever, like this plane won't crash. Like, these two things have nothing in relation to do with each other, but the force of the repetition compulsion is a psychic energy unto itself. I think she's trying to do is like summon that. We don't always have to like square what we're doing with a form of rationality or even a belief, but just keep doing.
100%.
I'm adding a lot that she didn't say, but I'm just speculating on what was useful to me about it.
Totally. Well, actually, too, and for our listeners with Outbeat, you may or may not be familiar with Lara Sheehy's work. I will put her site in the show notes so you can investigate it. And I've also interviewed her on my Substack, so you can go check that out and listen to some of the conversations. She's put so much. She's very generous with
The
her
brilliant
resources.
psychoanalyst. Yeah, a brilliant psychoanalyst.
Yeah, I think what you're speaking in this idea of like repeating again and again, it's so necessary, I think, to like queer and trans people to just, even in that act of repeating, to push back on power is so important. And
Yes.
right now at this time, it's like, organizing, getting together with people and participating, even if it feels like a small act, is not a small act. And even, your book, I just want to highlight and lift that up again too, as well, to conclude here in just a moment. But the work that you have put out for people, there's a way in which I've described that this book, it seduced me, it pulls me in, and there's a way in which I like having a relationship with these characters, and you can see as a reader inside of this transphobic person character. For some reasons, she's delightful because she's very funny, using satire as a device to teach, but also to illustrate underneath, like that there's nothing, that underneath those constructions and psychic formations is a nothingness. And I think for people that are queer and trans, reading this book can be helpful to remember these monsters are like empty, and we can push back.
Yeah, I think, and we've got to satirize it too. Like, it's a small thing. It's not what will bring about a revolution or a general strike, but it is part of building a culture of the left. Because the right is building a culture of the right, and they're not going back and forth on whether it's useful or not. They know it's useful and they're doing it. We need to do it too, and we are doing it. But you know, it's kind of simple in a way. It's like, yeah.
Jordy, thank you so much for coming to chat with us here at Outbeat.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for reading the book. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Totally. Yeah. And so again, once again, listeners, get Night Night Fawn by Jordy Rosenberg. Check this novel out. And if you have any thoughts about it, you can shoot them over to me on the show. Thank you so much, Jordy.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. So I give it up to you. You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we're gonna walk it out. Move mountains, we're gonna walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise like the day. I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I'll do it a thousand times again. And I'll rise up, I like the waves. I'll rise up in spite of the ache. I'll rise up, and I'll do it a thousand. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.